God invites you always to your highest thought about yourself. There are those on your planet right now who have manifested many of these higher thoughts, including causing physical objects to appear and disappear, making themselves appear and disappear, even living forever in the body or coming back to the body and living again. And all of this has been made possible because of their faith, because of their knowing, because of their immutable clarity about how things are and how they are meant to be. And while in the past, whenever people in earthly form have done these things, you have called the events miracles and have made the people saints and saviors, yet they are no more saints and saviors than you, for you are all saints and saviors, which is the very message they have been bringing you.
How can I believe that? I want to believe that with all my heart, but I can't. I just can't.
No, you cannot believe it. You can only know it.
But how can I know it? How can I come to that?
Whatever you choose for yourself, give to another. If you cannot come to that, help someone else come to that. Tell someone else that they already have. Praise them for it. Honor them for it. This is the value in having a guru. That's the whole point. There's been a lot of negative energy in the West on the word guru. It has almost become pejorative. To be a guru is to somehow be a charlatan. To give your allegiance to a guru is to somehow give your power away. Honoring your guru is not giving away your power. It is getting your power. For when you honor the guru, when you praise your master teacher, what you say is, I see you. And what you see in another, you can begin to see in yourself. It is outward evidence of your inner reality. It is outward proof of your inner truth, the truth of your being. This is the truth which is being brought through you in the books you write.
I don't see myself as writing these books. I see you, God, as the author, and me merely as the scribe.
God is the author, and so are you. There is no difference between my writing them and you writing them. As long as you think there is, you will have missed the point of the writing itself. Yet most of humanity has missed this teaching. And so I send you new teachers, more teachers, all with the same message as the teachers of old. I understand your reluctance to accept the teaching as your own personal truth. Were you to go around claiming to be one with God, or even a part of God, speaking or writing these words, the world would not know what to make of you.
People can make of me whatever they wish. This much I know. I don't deserve to be the recipient of the information I've been given here. And in all of these books, I don't feel worthy to be the messenger of this truth. I'm working on this third book, yet I know even before its release that I, of all people, with all the mistakes I've made, all the selfish things I've done, am simply not worthy to be the bringer of this wonderful truth. Yet that, perhaps, is the greatest message of this trilogy. That God stays hidden from no man, but speaks to everyone, even the least worthy among us. For if God will speak to me, God will speak directly into the heart of every man, woman, and child who seeks the truth. There is thus hope for all of us. None of us is so horrible that God would forsake us, nor so unforgivable that God would turn away.
Is that what you believe? All of that which you have just written?
Yes.
Then so be it, and so shall it be with you. Yet I tell you this, you are worthy, as is everyone else. Unworthiness is the worst indictment ever visited upon the human race. You have based your sense of worthiness on the past, while I base your sense of worthiness on the future. The future. The future. Always the future. That is where your life is, not in the past. The future. That is where your truth is, not in the past. What you have done is unimportant compared to what you are about to do. How you have erred is insignificant compared to how you are about to create. I forgive your mistakes, all of them. I forgive your misplaced passions, all of them. I forgive your erroneous notions, your misguided understandings, your hurtful actions, your selfish decisions, all of them. Others may not forgive you, but I do. Others may not release you from your guilt, but I do. Others may not let you forget, allow you to go on, become something new, but I do. For I know that you are not what you were, but are and always will be what you are now. A sinner can become a saint in 1 minute, in 1 second, in 1 breath. In truth, there is no such thing as a sinner, for no one can be sinned against, least of all me. That is why I say that I forgive you. I use the phrase because it is one you seem to understand. In truth, I do not forgive you and will not forgive you ever for anything. I do not have to. There is nothing to forgive, but I can release you. And I hereby do, now, once again, as I have done so often in the past, through the teachings of so many other teachers.
Why have we not heard them? Why have we not believed this, your greatest promise?
Because you cannot believe in the goodness of God. Forget then about believing in my goodness. Believe instead in simple logic. The reason I have no need to forgive you is that you cannot offend me, nor can I be damaged or destroyed. Yet you imagine yourself capable of offending, even damaging me. What a delusion. What a magnificent obsession. You cannot hurt me. Nor can I, for I am the unharmable. And that which cannot be harmed cannot and would not harm another. You understand now the logic behind the truth that I do not condemn, nor shall I punish, nor have I a need to seek retribution. I have no such need, for I have not been and cannot be offended or damaged or hurt in any way. The same is true of you and of all others. Though all of you imagine that you can be and have been hurt and damaged and destroyed. Because you imagine damage, you require revenge. Because you experience pain, you need another to experience pain as retribution for your own. Yet what possible justification can that be for inflicting pain upon another? Because you imagine someone has inflicted injury upon you, you feel it right and proper to inflict injury in return. That which you say is not okay for human beings to do to each other is okay for you to do so long as you are justified. This is insanity. And what you do not see in this insanity is that all people who inflict pain on others assume themselves to be justified. Every action a person takes is understood by that person to be the right action, given what it is they seek and desire. By your definition, what they seek and desire is wrong. But by their definition, it is not. You may not agree with their model of the world, with their moral and ethical constructions, with their theological understandings, nor with their decisions, choices, and actions, but they agree with them based on their values. You call their values wrong, but who's to say your values are right? Only you. Your values are right because you say they are. Even this might make some sense if you kept your word about it. But you yourself change your mind constantly about what you consider right and wrong. You do this as individuals and you do this as societies. What your society considered right just a few decades ago, you consider wrong today. What you considered wrong in the not too distant past, you now call right. Who could tell what is what? How do you know the players without a scorecard?
And yet we dare to sit in judgment of one another. We dare to condemn because some other person has failed to keep up with our own changing ideas about what is permitted and what is not. We're really something. We can't even keep our own minds made up about what's okay and what's not.
That isn't the problem. Changing your ideas of what's right and wrong isn't the problem. You have to change those ideas or you would never grow. Changing is a product of evolution. No, the problem is not that you have changed or that your values have changed. The problem is that so many of you insist on thinking that the values you now have are the right and perfect ones, and that everyone else should adhere to them. Some of you have become self-justified and self-righteous. Stick to your beliefs, if that serves you. Hold tight, do not waver, for your ideas about right and wrong are your definitions of who you are. Yet do not require that others define themselves according to your terms. And do not stay so stuck in your present beliefs and customs that you halt the process of evolution itself. Actually, you could not do that if you wanted to, for life goes on with you or without you. Nothing stays the same, nor can anything remain unchanged. To be unchanged is to not move, and to not move is to die. All of life is motion. Even rocks are filled with motion. Everything moves. Everything. There is nothing that is not in motion. Therefore, by the very fact of motion, nothing is the same from one moment to the next. Nothing. Remaining the same or seeking to moves against the laws of life. This is foolish, because in this struggle, life will always win. So change. Yes, change. Change your ideas of right and wrong. Change your notions of this and that. Change your structures, your constructions, your models, your theories. Allow your deepest truths to be altered. Alter them yourself, for goodness sake. I mean that quite literally. Alter them yourself, for goodness sake. Because your new idea of who you are is where the growth is. Your new idea of what is so is where evolution accelerates. Your new idea of the who, what, where, when, how, and why of it is where the mystery gets solved, the plot unravels, the story ends. Then you can begin a new story, and a grander one. Your new idea about all of it is where the excitement is, where the creation is, where God in you is made manifest and becomes fully realized. No matter how good you think things have been, they can be better. No matter how wonderful you think your theologies, your ideologies, your cosmologies, they can be full of even more wonder. For there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Be open, therefore. Be open. Don't close off the possibility of new truth because you've been comfortable with an old one. Life begins at the end of your comfort zone. Yet be not quick to judge another. Rather seek to avoid judgment, for another person's wrongs were your rights of yestermorn. Another person's mistakes are your own past actions, now corrected. Another person's choices and decisions are as hurtful and harmful, as selfish and unforgivable, as many of your own have been. It is when you just can't imagine how another person could do such a thing that you've forgotten where you came from and where both you and the other person are going. And to those of you who think yourselves to be the evil ones, who think yourselves to be unworthy and irredeemable, I tell you this. There's not a one among you who is lost forever, nor will there ever be. For you are all in the process of becoming. You are all moving through the experience of evolution. That is what I am up to. Through you.
I remember a prayer I was taught as a child. Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldst enter under my roof. Yet say but the word, and my soul shall be healed. You have said these words, and I feel healed. I no longer feel unworthy. You have a way of making me feel worthy. If I could give one gift to all human beings, that would be it.
You have given them that gift with this dialogue.
I would like to keep on giving it when this conversation is over.
This conversation will never be over.
Well, then, when this trilogy is complete.
There will be ways for you to do that.
For that, I'm very happy, because this is the gift my soul yearns to give. All of us have a gift to give. I'd like this to be mine.
Go then, and give it. Seek to make everyone whose life you touch feel worthy. Give everyone a sense of their own worthiness as a person, a sense of the true wonder of who they are. Give this gift, and you will heal the world.
I humbly ask your help.
You will always have it. We're friends.
Meanwhile, I'm loving this dialogue. I would like to ask a question about something you said before.
I'm here.
When you were talking about life between lives, so to speak, you said you may recreate the experience of your individual self whenever you choose. What does that mean?
It means you may emerge from the all anytime you wish, as a new self or the same self you were before.
You mean I can retain and return to my individual consciousness, my awareness of me?
Yes. You may have at all times whatever experience you desire.
And so I can return to this life? to the earth as the same person I was before I died?
Yes.
In the flesh?
Have you heard of Jesus?
Oh, yes, but I'm not Jesus, nor would I ever claim to be like him.
Did he not say, "These things and more shall you also do"?
Well, yes, but he wasn't talking about miracles like that, I don't think.
I'm sorry, you don't think so. Because Jesus was not the only one to have risen from the dead.
He wasn't? Others have risen from the dead?
Yes.
My God, that's blasphemy.
It's blasphemy that someone other than Christ has risen from the dead?
Well, some people would say that it is.
Then those people have never read the Bible.
The Bible? The Bible says that people other than Jesus came back to the body after death?
Ever hear of Lazarus?
Oh, no fair. It was through the Christ's power that he was raised from the dead.
Precisely. And you think that Christ's power, as you call it, was reserved only for Lazarus? One person in the history of the world?
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way.
I tell you this. Many have there been who have been risen from the dead. Many have there been who have come back to life. It's happening every day, right now, in your hospitals.
Oh, come on. No fair again. That's medical science, not theology.
Oh, I see. God has nothing to do with today's miracles, only yesterday's.
Okay. Okay, I'll give you the point on technical grounds, but no one has raised himself from the dead on their own like Jesus did. No one has come back from the dead that way.
Are you sure?
Well, pretty sure.
Have you ever heard of Mahavatar Babaji?
I don't think we should bring Eastern mystics into this. A lot of people don't buy that stuff.
I see. Well, of course, they must be right.
Well, let me get this straight. Are you saying that souls can return from the so-called dead in spirit form or in physical form, if that's what they desire?
You're beginning to understand now.
All right, then why haven't more people done it? Why don't we hear about it every day? This kind of thing would make international news.
Actually, a lot of people do it in spirit form. Not many, I'll admit, choose to return to the body.
Ha! There, I gotcha. Why not? If this is so easy, why don't more souls do it?
It's not a question of ease. It's a question of desirability.
Meaning?
Meaning it's a very rare soul who desires to return to physicality in the same form as before. If a soul chooses to return to the body, it almost always does so with another body, a different one. In this way, it begins a new agenda, experiences new rememberings, undertakes new adventures. Generally, souls leave bodies because they're finished with them. They've completed what they joined with the body to do. They've experienced the experience they were seeking.
What about people who die by accident? Were they finished with their experience, or was it cut off?
Do you still imagine people die by accident?
You mean they don't?
Nothing in this universe occurs by accident. There is no such thing as an accident, nor is there any such thing as coincidence.
If I could convince myself that was true, I would never mourn again for those who have died.
Oh, mourning for them is the last thing they would want you to do. If you knew where they were and that they were there by their own higher choice, you would celebrate their departure. If you experienced what you call the afterlife for one moment, having come to it with your grandest thought about yourself and God, you would smile the biggest smile at their funeral and let joy fill your heart.
We cry at funerals for our loss. It's our sadness in knowing that we will never see them again, never hold or hug or touch or be with someone we loved.
And that is a good crying. That honors your love and your beloved. Yet even this mourning would be short if you knew what grand realities and wondrous experiences await the joyous soul leaving the body.
What is it like in the afterlife? Really, tell me. Tell me all of it.
There are some things which cannot be revealed, not because I do not choose to, but because in your present condition, at your present level of understanding, you would be unable to conceive of what is being told to you. Still, there is more which can be said. As we discussed earlier, you may do one of three things in what you call the afterlife, just as in the life you are now experiencing. You may submit to the creations of your uncontrolled thoughts. You may create your experience consciously out of choice, or you may experience the collective consciousness of all that is. This last experience is called reunification, or rejoining the One. Should you take the first path, most of you will not do so for very long, unlike the way you behave on Earth. This is because in the moment you don't like what you're experiencing, you will choose to create a new and more pleasant reality, which you will do by simply stopping your negative thoughts. Because of this, you will never experience the hell of which you are so afraid, unless you choose to. Even in that case, you will be happy in that you will be getting what you want. More people than you know are happy being miserable. So you will keep experiencing it until you don't choose to anymore. For most of you, the moment you even begin to experience it, you will move away from it and create something new. You can eliminate the hell in your life on earth exactly the same way. Should you take the second path and consciously create your experience, you will no doubt experience going straight to heaven, because this is what anyone who is freely choosing and who believes in heaven would create. If you do not believe in heaven, you will experience whatever you wish to experience, and the moment you understand that, your wishes will get better and better, and then you will believe in heaven. Should you take the third path and submit to the creations of the collective consciousness, you will move very quickly into total acceptance, total peace, total joy, total awareness, and total love, for that is the consciousness of the collective. Then you will become one with the oneness, and there will be nothing else except that which you are, which is all there ever was, until you decide that there should be something else. This is nirvana, the one with the oneness experience that many of you have had briefly in meditation. And it is an indescribable ecstasy. After you experience the oneness for an infinite time, no time, you will cease to experience it, because you cannot experience the oneness as oneness unless and until that which is not one also exists. Understanding this, you will create, once again, the idea and the thought of separation or disunity. Then you will keep traveling on the cosmic wheel, keep going, keep circling, keep on being forever and ever, and even forevermore. You will return to the oneness many times, an infinite number of times, and for an infinite period each time. And you will know that you have the tools to return to the oneness at any point on the cosmic wheel. You may do so now, even as you are hearing this. You may do so tomorrow in your meditation. You may do so at any time.
And you've said that we do not have to stay at the level of consciousness we're at when we die?
No. You may move to another as quickly as you wish, or take as much time as you like. If you die in a state of limited perspective and uncontrolled thoughts, you'll experience whatever that state brings you until you don't want it anymore. Then you'll wake up, become conscious, and start experiencing yourself creating your reality. You'll look back at the first stage and call it purgatory. The second stage, when you can have anything you want with the speed of your thought, you'll call heaven. The third stage, when you experience the bliss of the oneness, you'll call nirvana.
I have one more thing I'd like to explore along these lines. It's not about after death, but it is about experiences outside the body. Can you explain those to me? What's happening there?
The essence of who you are has simply left the physical body. This can happen during normal dreaming, often during meditation, and frequently in a sublime form while the body is in deep sleep. During such an excursion, your soul can be anywhere it wishes. Frequently,
the person reporting such an experience has no after memory of having made volitional decisions about this. They may experience it as just something that happened to me. However, nothing which involves an activity of the soul is non-volitional.
How can we be shown things? How can things be revealed to us during one of these experiences if all we are doing is creating as we go along? Seems to me that the only way things could be revealed to us would be if those things existed separate from us, not as part of our own creation. I need some help with this.
Nothing exists separate from you, and everything is your own creation. Even your apparent lack of understanding is your own creation. It is literally a figment of your imagination. You imagine that you do not know the answer to this question, and so you do not. Yet as soon as you imagine that you do, you do. You allow yourself to do this sort of imagining so that the process can go on.
The process?
Life. The eternal process. In those moments during which you experience yourself being revealed to yourself, whether these are what you call out-of-body experiences or dreams or magic moments of wakefulness when you are greeted by crystal clarity, what has happened is that you have simply slipped into remembering. You are remembering what you have already created, and these rememberings can be very powerful. They can produce a personal epiphany. Once you've had such a magnificent experience, it can be very difficult to go back to real life in a way that blends well with what other people are calling reality. That is because your reality has shifted. It has become something else. It has expanded, grown, and it cannot be shrunk again. It's like trying to get the genie back in the bottle. It can't be done.
Well, is that why so many people who come back from out-of-body experiences or so-called near-death experiences sometimes seem very different?
Exactly. And they are different because now they know so much more. Yet frequently, the further they get from such experiences, the more time that passes, the more they revert to their old behaviors because they have again forgotten what they know.
Is there any way to keep remembering?
Yeah. Act out your knowingness in every moment. Keep acting on what you know rather than what the world of illusion is showing you. Stay with it no matter how deceiving appearances are. This is what all masters have done and do. They judge not by appearances, but act according to what they know. And there is another way to remember.
Yes?
Cause another to remember. That which you wish for yourself, give to another.
That's what I feel I'm doing with these books.
That is exactly what you are doing. The longer you keep on doing it, the less you will have to do it. The more you send this message to another, the less you will have to send it to yourself.
Because myself and the other are one. And what I give to another, I give to myself.
You see? Now you are giving me the answers. And that, of course, is how it works.
Wow, I just gave God an answer. That is cool. That is really cool.
You're telling me.
That's what's cool. The fact that I'm telling you.
And I will tell you this. The day will come when we will speak as one. That day will come for all people.
Well, if that day is going to come for me, I'd like to make sure I understand exactly what it is you're saying. So I'd like to go back to something else just one more time. I know you said this more than once, but I really want to make sure I understand it. Am I clear that once we reach this state of oneness, which many call nirvana, once we return to the source, we don't stay there? The reason I'm asking this again is that this seems to run counter to my understanding of many Eastern esoteric and mystical teachings.
To remain in the state of sublime no-thing or oneness with the all would make it impossible to be there. As I've just explained, that which is cannot be, except in the space of that which is not. Even the total bliss of oneness cannot be experienced as total bliss unless something less than total bliss exists. So, something less than the total bliss of total oneness had to be, and continually has to be.
But when we are in total bliss, when we have merged once more with the oneness, when we have become everything no-thing, how can we even know that we exist? I mean, since there's nothing else that we are experiencing, I don't know. I don't seem to be able to understand this. This is one thing I can't seem to get a handle on.
You are describing what I call the divine dilemma. This is the same dilemma God has always had, and that God solved with the creation of that which was not God, or thought it was not. God gave and gives again in every instant a part of itself to the lesser experience of not knowing itself, so that the rest of itself can know itself as who and what it really is. Thus, God gave his only begotten Son that you might be saved. You see now from where this mythology has sprung.
Well, I think that we're all God, that we are constantly, every one of us, journeying from knowing to not knowing to knowing again, from being to not being to being again, from oneness to separation to oneness again, in a never-ending cycle. That this is the cycle of life, what you call the cosmic wheel.
Exactly. Precisely. That is well said.
But do we all have to go back to ground zero? Do we always have to start over completely, go back to the beginning, return to square one, do not pass go, do not collect $200?
You do not have to do anything. Not in this lifetime. Not in any other. You will have choice. Always you will have free choice to go anywhere you wish to go, do anything you wish to do in your recreation of the experience of God. You can move to any place on the cosmic wheel. may come back as anything you wish, or in any other dimension, reality, solar system, or civilization you choose. Some of those who have reached the place of total union with the divine have even chosen to come back as enlightened masters. And yes, some were enlightened masters when they left, and then chose to come back as themselves. You must surely be aware of reports of gurus and masters who have returned to your world over and over again, manifesting in repeated appearances throughout the decades and centuries. You have one entire religion based on such a report. It is called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and it is based on the report of Joseph Smith that the being calling himself Jesus returned to Earth many centuries after his apparently final departure, this time appearing in the United States. So you may return to any point on the cosmic wheel to which it pleases you to return.
Still, even that could be depressing. Don't we ever get to rest? Don't we ever get to stay in nirvana? To remain there? Are we doomed forever to this coming and going? This now you see it, now you don't treadmill? Are we on an eternal journey to nowhere?
Yes, that's the greatest truth. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do, and no one you have to be.
Except exactly who you're being right now. The truth is that there is no journey. You are right now what you are attempting to be. You are right now where you are attempting to go. It is the master who knows this, and thus ends the struggle. And then does the master seek to assist you in ending your struggle, even as you will seek to end the struggle of others when you reach mastery. Yet this process, this cosmic wheel, is not a depressing treadmill. It is a glorious and continual reaffirmation of the utter magnificence of God and all life, and there is nothing depressing about that at all.
Still seems depressing to me.
Let me see if I can change your mind. Do you like sex?
I love it.
Most people do, except those with really weird ideas about it. So what if I told you that beginning tomorrow, you can have sex with every single person for whom you felt attraction and love? Would that make you happy?
Would this have to be against their will?
No, I would arrange it so that everyone you wish to celebrate the human experience of love with in this way also wishes to do so with you. They would feel great attraction and love for you.
Wow, hey, okay.
There's just one condition. You have to stop between each one. You can't just go from one to the other without interruption.
You're telling me.
So in order to experience the ecstasy of this kind of physical union, you have to also experience not being united sexually with someone, if only for a while.
I think I see where you're going.
Yes. Even the ecstasy would not be ecstasy were there not a time when there was no ecstasy. This is as true with spiritual ecstasy as it is with physical. There is nothing depressing about the cycle of life. There is only joy. Simply joy and more joy. True masters are never less than joyful. This staying at the level of mastery is what you may now find desirable. Then you can move in and out of the ecstasy and still be joyful always. You do not need the ecstasy to be joyful. You are joyful simply knowing that ecstasy is.
I'd like to change the subject now, if I could, and talk about Earth changes. But before I do, I'd like to make just an observation, if I could. It seems as though there are a lot of things being said here more than once. I sometimes feel like I'm hearing the same things over and over again.
That's good, because you are. As I said earlier, this is by design. This message is like a spring. When it is coiled, it circles back onto itself. One circle covers the other, and it seems to be literally going around in circles.
Mm-hmm.
Only when the spring is uncoiled will you see that it stretches out in a spiral farther than you could have ever imagined. Yes, you are right. Much of what is being said has been said a number of times in different ways, sometimes in the same way. The observation is correct. When you are finished with this message, you should be able to repeat its essential points virtually verbatim. The day may come when you may wish to.
Okay, fair enough. Now, moving forward, a bunch of people seem to think that I have a direct line to God, and they want to know, is our planet doomed? I know I've asked this before, but now I'd really like a direct answer. Will the Earth changes occur, as so many are predicting? And if not, what are all those psychics seeing? A made-up vision? Should we be praying, changing? Is there anything we can do, or is it all sadly hopeless?
I will be happy to address those questions, but we will not be moving forward.
We won't?
No, because the answers have already been given you in my several previous explanations of time.
Ah, you mean the part about everything that's ever going to happen has already happened?
Yes.
But what is the everything that has already happened? How did it happen? What happened?
All of it happened. All of it has already happened. Every possibility exists as fact, as completed events.
How can that be? I don't understand how that can be.
I'm going to put this in terms to which you can better relate. See if this helps. Have you ever watched children use a CD-ROM to play a computerized video game?
Yes.
Have you ever asked yourself how the computer knows how to respond to every move the child makes with the joystick?
Yes, actually, I have wondered that.
It's all on the disc. The computer knows how to respond to every move the child makes because every possible move has already been placed on the disc, along with its appropriate response.
That's spooky. Almost surreal.
What? That every ending and every twist and turn producing that ending is already programmed on the disc? There's nothing spooky about it. It's just technology. And if you think that the technology of video games is something, wait till you see the technology of the universe. Think of the cosmic wheel as that CD-ROM. All the endings already exist. The universe is just waiting to see which one you choose this time. And when the game is over, whether you win, lose, or draw, the universe will say, "Wanna play again?" Your computer disk doesn't care whether you win or not, and you can't hurt its feelings. It just offers you a chance to play again. All the endings already exist. And which ending you experience depends on the choices you make.
Whoa. So God is nothing more than a CD-ROM.
I wouldn't put it that way exactly.
Okay.
But throughout this dialogue, I've been trying to use illustrations that embody concepts everyone can hold in their understanding. So I think the CD-ROM illustration is a good one. In many ways, life is like a CD-ROM. All the possibilities exist and have already occurred. Now you get to select which one you choose to experience. This relates directly to your question about Earth changes. What many of the psychics are saying about the Earth changes is true. They've opened a window onto the future and they have seen it. The question is, which future have they seen? As with the end of the game on the CD-ROM, there is more than one version. In one version, the Earth will be in upheaval. In another version, it won't. Actually, all of the versions have already happened. Remember? Time...
I know. Time does not exist.
That's right. And so?
So, everything's happening at once.
Right again. All that has ever happened is happening now and ever will happen exists right now. Just as all the moves in the computer game exist right now on that disc. So if you think it would be interesting for the doomsday predictions of the psychics to come true, focus all your attention on that, and you can draw that to yourself. And if you think you would like to experience a different reality, focus on that, and that is the outcome you can draw to you.
So you won't tell me whether the Earth changes will occur or not, is that it?
I'm waiting for you to tell me. You will decide by your thoughts, words, and actions.
Okay, well, how about the year 2000 computer problem? There are those who are saying now that what we are now calling the Y2K glitch is going to be the cause of a great upheaval in our social and economic systems. Will it be?
What do you say? What do you choose? Do you think that you have nothing to do with any of this? I tell you, that would be inaccurate.
Won't you just tell us how this will all turn out?
I am not here to predict your future, and I will not do that. This much I can tell you. This much anybody can tell you. If you are not careful, you will get exactly where you are going. If, therefore, you don't like the way you are headed, change direction.
How do I do that? How do I affect such a large outcome? What should we do in the face of all these predictions of disaster by persons of psychic or spiritual authority?
Go inside. Search your place of inner wisdom. See what this calls on you to do, then do it. If that means write your politicians and your industrialists, asking them to take action on environmental abuses that could lead to earth changes, do it. If that means bringing your community leaders together to work on the Y2K problem, do it. And if that means just walking your path, sending out positive energy every day, and keeping those around you from falling into a panic which brings on a problem, most important of all, do not be afraid. You cannot die in any event, so there's nothing to be afraid of. Be aware of the process unfolding, and quietly know that everything is going to be okay with you. Seek to get in touch with the perfection of all things. Know that you will be exactly where you have to be in order to experience exactly what you choose as you go about creating who you really are. This is the way to peace. In all things, see the perfection. Finally, don't try to get out of anything. What you resist persists. I told you that in the first book, and it's true. People who are sad about what they see in the future, or what they've been told about the future, are failing to stay in the perfection.
Okay, any other advice?
Celebrate! Celebrate life! Celebrate self! Celebrate the prediction! Celebrate God! Celebrate! Play the game! Bring joy to the moment, whatever the moment seems to bring, because joy is who you are and who you will always be. God cannot create anything imperfect. If you think that God can create anything imperfect, then you know nothing of God. So celebrate. Celebrate the perfection. Smile and celebrate and see only the perfection. And that which others call the imperfection will not touch you in any way which is imperfect for you.
You mean I can avoid the Earth shifting on its axis, or being smashed by a meteor, or being crumpled by earthquakes, or being caught in a confusing and hysterical aftermath of Y2K?
You can definitely avoid being affected negatively by any of that.
That isn't what I asked you.
But it is what I answered. Face the future fearlessly, understanding the process, and seeing the perfection of all of it. That peace, that serenity, that calmness will lead you away from most of the experiences and outcomes others would have called negative.
What if you are wrong about all of this? What if you are not God at all, but just the overworkings of my fertile imagination?
Back to that question, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what if? So what? Can you think of a better way to live? All I'm saying here is to stay calm. Stay peaceful. Stay serene. In the face of these dire predictions of planet-wide calamity, and you will have the best outcome possible. Even if I'm not God, and I'm just you, making it all up, can you get any better advice?
No, I think not.
So, as usual, it makes no difference whether I'm God or not. But this is with the information in all three books, just live the wisdom. Or if you can think of a better way to proceed, do that. Look, even if it really is just Neil Donald Walsh doing the talking in all these books, you can hardly find better advice to follow on any of the subjects covered. So look at it this way. Either I am God talking, or this Neil fellow's a pretty bright guy. What's different?
Well, the difference is, if I were convinced it was really God saying these things, I'd listen more closely.
Oh, bananas. I've sent you messages 1,000 times in 100 different forms. You've ignored most of them.
Yeah, I suppose I have.
You suppose?
Okay, I have.
So this time, don't ignore. Who do you suppose brought you to this book? You did. So if you can't listen to God, listen to yourself.
Or my friendly psychic.
Or your friendly psychic.
You're kidding with me now, I know, but this does bring up another subject I wanted to discuss.
I know.
You know?
Of course. You want to discuss psychics.
How did you know?
I'm psychic.
Hey, I'll bet you are. You're the mother of all psychics. You're the chief honcho, the top banana, the big cheese. You're the man, the boss, the unit, the chairman of the board.
My man, you have got it right.
Give me fire.
Cool, brother. Right on.
So what I want to know is, what is psychic power?
You all have what you call psychic power. It is truly a sixth sense. And you all have a sixth sense about things. Psychic power is simply
the ability to step out of your limited experience into a broader view, to step back, to feel more than what the limited individual you have imagined yourself to be would feel, to know more than he or she would know. It is the ability to tap into the larger truth all around you, to sense a different energy.
How does one develop this ability?
Develop is a good word. It's sort of like muscle. You all have them, yet some of you choose to develop them, whereas in others they remain undeveloped and far less useful. To develop your psychic muscle, you must exercise it, use it, every day, all the time. Right now, the muscle is there, but it's small, it's weak, it's underused. So you'll get an intuitive hit now and then, but you won't act on it. You'll get a hunch about something, but you'll ignore it. You'll have a dream or an inspiration, but you'll let it pass, paying it scant attention. Thank goodness you did pay attention to the hit you had about this book, or you wouldn't be hearing these words now. You think you came to these words by accident? By chance? So the first step in developing psychic power is to know you have it and to use it. Pay attention to every hunch you have, every feeling you feel, every intuitive hit you experience. Pay attention. Then act on what you know. Don't let your mind talk you out of it. Don't let your fear pull you away from it. The more that you act on your intuition fearlessly, the more your intuition will serve you. It was always there, only now you're paying attention to it.
But I'm not talking about the always finding a parking space kind of psychic ability. I'm talking about real psychic power, the kind that sees into the future, the kind that lets you know things about people you'd have no way of knowing otherwise.
That's what I was talking about, too.
Well, how does this psychic power work? Should I listen to people who have it? If a psychic makes a prediction, can I change it, or is my future set in stone? How can some psychics tell things about you the minute you walk into the room? What if I were...
Wait. That's four different questions there. Let's slow down a bit and try one at a time.
All right. How does psychic power work?
There are three rules of psychic phenomena that will allow you to understand how psychic power works. Let's go over them. 1. All thought is energy. 2. All things are in motion. 3. All time is now. Psychics are people who have opened themselves to the experiences these phenomena produce. Vibrations. Sometimes formed as pictures in the mind, sometimes a thought in the form of a word. The psychic becomes adept at feeling these energies. This may not be easy at first because these energies are very light, very fleeting, very subtle, like the slightest breeze on a summer night that you think you felt rustle your hair, but maybe didn't. Like the faintest sound in the farthest distance that you think you heard but can't be sure. Like the dimmest flicker of an image at the corner of your eye that you swore was there, but when you look head on, it's gone, vanished. Was it there at all? That's the question the beginning psychic is always asking. The accomplished psychic never asks, because to ask the question sends the answer away. Asking the question engages the mind. And that's the last thing a psychic wants to do. Intuition does not reside in the mind. To be psychic, you've got to be out of your mind, because intuition resides in the psyche, in the soul. Intuition is the ear of the soul. The soul is the only instrument sensitive enough to pick up life's faintest vibrations, to feel these energies, to sense these waves in the field, and to interpret them. You have 6 senses, not 5. They are your sense of smell, taste, touch, sight, hearing, and knowing. So here is how psychic power works. Every time you have a thought, it sends off an energy. It is energy. The soul of the psychic picks up that energy. The true psychic will not stop to interpret it, but will probably just blurt out what the energy feels like. That's how a psychic can tell you what you're thinking. Every feeling you've ever had resides in your soul. Your soul is the sum total of all your feelings. It is the repository. Even though it may have been years since you've stored them there, a psychic who is truly open can feel these feelings here and now. That's because, altogether now, There's no such thing as time. That's how a psychic can tell you about your past. Tomorrow also doesn't exist. All things are occurring right now. Every occurrence sends off a wave of energy, prints an indelible picture on the cosmic photographic plate. The psychic sees or feels the picture of tomorrow as if it's happening right now, which it is. That is how some psychics tell the future. How is this done physiologically? Perhaps without actually knowing what he's doing, a psychic, through the act of intense focusing, is sending out an actual submolecular component of himself. His thought, if you will, leaves the body, zings out into space, and goes far enough, fast enough, to be able to turn around and see from a distance the now that you have not yet experienced.
Submolecular time travel.
You could say that.
Submolecular time travel.
Okay. We've decided to turn this into a vaudeville show.
No. I'll be good, I promise. Really. Go on. I really do want to hear this.
Okay. The submolecular part of the psychic, having absorbed the energy of the image gained from focusing, zings back to the psychic's body, bringing the energy with it. The psychic gets a picture, sometimes with a shiver, or feels a feeling, and tries very hard not to do any processing of the data, but simply and instantly describes it. The psychic has learned not to question what he's thinking or suddenly seeing or feeling, but merely to allow it to come through as untouched as possible. Weeks later, if the event pictured or felt actually occurs, the psychic is called a clairvoyant, which of course is true.
Well, if that's the case, how come some predictions are wrong? That is, that they never happen.
Because the psychic has not predicted the future, merely offered a glimpse of one of the possible possibilities observed in the eternal moment of now. It is always the subject of the psychic reading who has made the choice. He could just as easily make another choice, a choice not in concert with the prediction. The eternal moment contains all possible possibilities. As I've explained now several times, everything has already happened in a million different ways. All that's left is for you to make some perception choices. It's all a question of perception. When you change your perception, you change your thought. And your thought creates your reality. Whatever outcome you could anticipate in any situation is already there for you. All you have to do is perceive it, know it. This is what is meant by, even before you ask, I will have answered. In truth, your prayers are answered before the prayer is offered.
Then how come we don't all get what we pray for?
This was covered in Book One. You don't always get what you ask, but you always get what you create. Creation follows thought, which follows perception.
Oh, man, this is mind-boggling. Even though we've been over this before, this is still mind-boggling.
Isn't it, though? That's why it's good to keep going over it. Hearing it several times gives you a chance to wrap your mind around it. Then your mind gets unboggled.
Well, if everything is all happening now, what dictates which part of it all I'm experiencing in my moment of now?
Your choices and your belief in your choices. That belief will be created by your thoughts on a particular subject, and those thoughts arise out of your perceptions, that is, the way you look at it. So the psychic sees the choice you are now making about tomorrow and sees that played out. But a true psychic will always tell you it doesn't have to be that way. You can choose again and change the outcome.
In effect, I'd be changing the experience I've already had.
Exactly. Now you're getting it. Now you're understanding how to live in the paradox.
But if it's already happened, to whom has it happened? And if I change it, who is the me that experiences the change?
There is more than one of you moving down the timeline. This was all described in detail in Book Two. I'm going to suggest that you go over that. Then combine what's there with what's here for a richer understanding.
Okay, fair enough. But I would like to talk about this psychic stuff a while longer. A lot of people claim to be psychic. How can I tell the real from the fake?
Well, everyone is psychic, so they're all real. What you want to look for is their purpose. Are they seeking to help you or to enrich themselves? Psychics, so-called professional psychics, who are seeking to enrich themselves, often promise to do things with their psychic power. Return a lost lover, bring wealth and fame, even help you lose weight. They promise they can do all this, but only for a fee. They'll even do a reading on another, your boss, your lover, a friend, and tell you all about them. They'll say, bring me something, a scarf, a picture, a sample of their handwriting. And they can tell you about the other, often quite a bit, because everyone leaves a trace, a psychic fingerprint, an energy trail, and a true sensitive can feel this. But a sincere intuitive will never offer to cause another to come back to you, get a person to change his mind, or create any result whatsoever with her psychic power. A true psychic, one who has given her life to the development and use of this gift, knows that another's free will is never to be tampered with, and that another's thoughts are never to be invaded, and that another's psychic space is never to be violated.
I thought you said there is no right and wrong. What are all these nevers all of a sudden?
Every time I lay down an always or a never, it is within the context of what I know you are seeking to accomplish, what it is you are trying to do. I know that you are all seeking to evolve, to grow spiritually, to return to the oneness. You are seeking
to experience yourself as the grandest version of the greatest vision you ever had about who you are. You are seeking this individually and as a race. Now there are no rights and wrongs, no do's and don'ts in my world, as I have said many times. And you do not burn in the everlasting fires of hell if you make a bad choice, because neither bad nor hell exists, unless, of course, you think that it does. Still, there are natural laws that have been built into the physical universe. And one of those is the law of cause and effect. One of the most important laws of cause and effect is this. All caused effect is ultimately experienced by the self.
What does that mean?
Whatever you cause another to experience, you will one day experience. Members of your New Age community have a more colorful way of putting it.
What goes around comes around.
Right. Others know this as the Jesus injunction. Do unto others as you would have it done unto you. Jesus was teaching the law of cause and effect. It is what might be called the prime law, somewhat like the prime directive given to Kirk, Picard, and Janeway.
Hey, God is a Trekkie.
Are you kidding? I wrote half the episodes.
Better not let Gene hear you say that.
Come on. Gene told me to say that.
You're in touch with Gene Roddenberry?
And Carl Sagan, and Bob Heinlein, and the whole gang up here.
You know, we shouldn't get around like this. It takes away from the believability of the whole dialogue.
I see. A conversation with Gunn has to be serious.
Well, at least believable.
It's not believable that I've got Gene, Carl, and Bob right here?
Well,
I'll have to tell them that. Well, back to how you can tell a true psychic from a fake one. A true psychic knows and lives the prime directive. That's why if you ask her to bring back a long-lost love or read the aura of another person whose handkerchief or letter you have, a true psychic will tell you, I'm sorry, but I won't do that. I will never interfere with, intervene in, or look in on the path walked by another. I will not attempt to affect, direct, or impact their choices in any way. And I will not divulge to you information about any individual that is personal or private. If a person offers to perform one of these services for you, that person is what you would call a shyster, using your own human weaknesses and vulnerabilities to extract money from you.
But what about psychics who help people locate a missing loved one? A child who was abducted, a teenager who ran away and has too much pride to call home, even though they desperately want to. Or how about the classic case of locating a person, dead or alive, for the police?
Of course. These questions all answer themselves. What the true psychic always avoids is imposing his will upon another. She is there only to serve.
Is it okay to ask a psychic to contact the dead? Should we attempt to reach out to those who have gone before?
Why would you want to?
Well, to see if they have something they want to say to us, to tell us.
If somebody from the other side has something they want you to know, they'll find a way to cause you to know it. Don't worry. The aunt, the uncle, the brother, the sister, the father, the mother, the spouse, and lover who have gone before are continuing their own journey, experiencing complete joy, moving toward total understanding. If part of what they want to do is to come back to you, to see how you are, to bring you an awareness that they're all right, whatever, trust that they'll do that.
Then watch for the sign and catch it. Don't dismiss it as just your imagination, wishful thinking, or coincidence. Watch for the message and receive it.
I know a lady who was nursing her dying husband, and she begged him, if he had to go, please come back to her and let her know that he was all right. Well, he promised he would and died 2 days later. Not a week went by when the lady was awakened one night by the feeling that someone had just sat down on the bed beside her. When she opened her eyes, she could have sworn she saw her husband sitting at the foot of the bed, smiling at her. But when she blinked and looked again, he was gone. She told me this story later, saying then that she must have been hallucinating.
Yes, that's very common. You receive signs, irrefutable, obvious signs, and you ignore them, or dismiss them as your own mind playing tricks on you. You have the same choice now with this book.
Why do we do that? Why do we ask for something like the wisdom contained in these three books, then refuse to believe it when we receive it?
Because you doubt the greater glory of God.
Because you what?
Because you doubt the greater glory of God. Capiche?
I got it.
Like Thomas, you have to see, feel, touch before you will believe. Yet that which you wish to know cannot be seen, felt, or touched. It is of another realm. And you are not open to that. You are not ready. Yet do not fret. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
So, you're saying then, to get back to the original line of questioning, that we should not go to a psychic or a seance seeking to contact those on the other side?
I'm not saying that you should or shouldn't do anything. I'm just not sure what the point would be.
Well, supposing you had something you wanted to say to the other rather than something you wanted to hear from them.
Do you imagine that you could say it and they not hear it? The slightest thought having to do with the being existing on what you call the other side brings that being's consciousness flying to you. You cannot have a thought or an idea about a person who is what you call deceased without that person's essence becoming completely aware of it. It is not necessary to use a medium to produce such communication. Love is the best medium of communication.
But how about two-way communication? Would a medium be helpful there, or is such communication even possible? Is it all hogwash? Is it dangerous?
You are talking now about communication with spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, such communication is possible. Is it dangerous? Virtually everything is dangerous if you are afraid. What you fear, you create. Yet there is really nothing to be afraid of. Loved ones are never far from you, never more than a thought away. They will always be there if you need them, ready with counsel or comfort or advice. If there is a high level of stress on your part about a loved one being okay, they will send you a sign, a signal, a little message that will allow you to know everything's fine. You won't even have to call on them because souls who loved you in this life are drawn to you, pulled to you, fly to you the moment they sense the slightest trouble or disturbance in your auric field. One of their first opportunities as they learn about the possibilities of their new existence is to provide aid and comfort to those they love, and you will feel their comforting presence if you are really open to them.
So the stories we hear of people who could have sworn that a deceased loved one was in the room could be true.
Most assuredly. One might smell the loved one's perfume or cologne, or get a whiff of the cigar they smoked, or faintly hear a song they used to hum. Or out of nowhere, some personal possession of theirs may suddenly appear. A handkerchief, or a wallet, or some cufflink, or piece of jewelry just shows up for no reason. It's found in a chair cushion, or under a stack of old magazines. There it is. A picture. A photograph of a special moment, just when you are missing that person and thinking about them and feeling sad about their death. These things don't just happen. These kinds of things don't just appear at just the right moment by chance. I tell you this, there are no coincidences in the universe. This is very common, very common. Now back to your question. Do you need a so-called medium or channel to communicate with beings out of the body? No. Is it sometimes helpful? Sometimes. So much depends again on the psychic or medium and on their motivation. If someone refuses to work in this way with you, or to do any kind of channeling or go-between work without high compensation, run, don't walk the other way. That person may be in it only for the money. Don't be surprised if you get hooked into returning time and time again for weeks or months or even years as they play on your need or desire for contact with the spirit world. A person who's only there as the spirit is there to help asks nothing for himself except what is needed to continue to do the work they seek to do. If a psychic or medium is coming from that place when she agrees to help you, make sure you offer all the help in return that you can. Don't take advantage of such extraordinary generosity of the spirit by giving little or not at all when you know you could do more. Look to see who is truly serving the world, truly seeking to share wisdom and knowledge, insight and understanding, caring and compassion. Provide for those people, and provide grandly. Pay them the highest honor. Give them the largest amount. For these are the bringers of the light.
Will you speak to me about reincarnation?
Sure.
Many religions say that reincarnation is a false doctrine, that we get only one life here, one chance.
I know. That is not accurate.
How can they be so wrong about something so important? How can they not know the truth about something so basic?
You must understand that humans have many fear-based religions whose teachings surround a doctrine of a God who is to be worshipped and feared. It was through fear that your entire Earth society reformed itself from the matriarchy to the patriarchy. It was through fear that the early priests got people to mend their wicked ways and heed the word of the Lord. It was through fear that churches gained and controlled their membership. One church even insisted that God would punish you if you did not go to church every Sunday. Not going to church was declared a sin, and not just any church. One had to attend one particular church. If you went to a church of a different denomination, that too was a sin. This was an attempt at control, pure and simple, using fear. The amazing thing is, it worked. Hell, it still works.
Say, you're God. Don't swear.
Who is swearing? I was making a statement of fact. I said, hell, it still works. People will always believe in hell and in a God who would send them there as long as they believe that God is like man, ruthless, self-serving, unforgiving, and vengeful. In days past, most people could not imagine a God who might rise above all of that. So they accepted the teaching of many churches to fear the terrible vengeance of the Lord. It was as if people couldn't trust themselves to be good, to act appropriately on their own for their own built-in reasons. So they had to create a religion that taught the doctrine of an angry, retributive God in order to keep themselves in line. Now, the idea of reincarnation threw a monkey wrench into all of that.
How so? What made that doctrine so threatening?
The church was proclaiming that you'd better be nice or else. And along came the reincarnationists saying, you'll have another chance after this, and another chance after that, and still more chances. So don't worry. Do the best you can. Don't become so paralyzed with fear that you can't budge. Promise yourself to do better and get on with it. Naturally, the early church couldn't hear of such a thing, so it did two things. First, it denounced the doctrine of reincarnation as heretical. Then it created the sacrament of confession. Confession could do for the churchgoer what reincarnation promised. That is, give him another chance.
So then we had a setup where God would punish you for your sins unless you confessed them. In that case, you could feel safe, knowing that God had heard your confession and had forgiven you.
Yes, but there was a catch.
Oh?
This absolution could not come directly from God. It had to flow through the church, whose priests pronounced penances which had to be performed. These were usually prayers which were required of the sinner. So now you had two reasons to keep up your membership. The church found confession to be such a good drawing card that soon it declared it to be a sin not to go to confession. Everybody had to do it at least once a year, If they didn't, God would have another reason to be angry. More and more rules, many of them arbitrary and capricious, began to be promulgated by the church, each rule having the power of God's eternal condemnation behind it, unless, of course, failure was confessed. Then the person was forgiven by God and condemnation avoided. But now there was another problem. People figured out that this must mean they could do anything as long as they confessed it. The church was in a quandary. Fear had left the hearts of the people. Church attendance and membership dropped. People came to confess once a year, said their penances, were absolved of their sins, and went on with their lives. There was no question about it. A way had to be found to strike fear into the heart again. So, purgatory was invented.
Purgatory?
Purgatory. This was described as a place something like hell, but not eternal. This new doctrine declared that God would make you suffer for your sins, even if you confess them.
Oh.
Under the doctrine, a certain amount of suffering was decreed by God for each non-perfect soul, based on the number and type of sins committed. There were mortal sins and venial sins. Mortal sins would send you right to hell if not confessed before death. Once more, church attendance shot up. Collections were up too, and especially contributions. For the doctrine of purgatory also included a way one could buy one's way out of the suffering.
I'm sorry?
According to the church's teaching, one could receive a special indulgence, but again, not directly from God, only from an official of the church. These special indulgences freed one from the suffering in purgatory, which they had earned with their sins, or at least part of it.
Something like time off for good behavior.
Yes, but of course these reprieves were granted to very few.
Mm.
Generally, those who made a conspicuous contribution to the church. For a really huge sum, one could obtain a plenary indulgence. This meant no time in purgatory at all. It was a non-stop ticket straight to heaven. This special favor from God was available for even fewer. Royalty, perhaps, and the super rich. The amount of money, jewels, and land given to the church in exchange for these plenary indulgences was enormous. But the exclusivity of all this brought great frustration and resentment to the masses. No pun intended. The poorest peasant had no hope of gaining a bishop's indulgence, and so the rank and file lost faith in the system, with attendance threatening to drop once again.
Now what did they do?
They brought in the novena candles. People could come to the church and light a novena candle for the poor souls in purgatory, and by saying a novena, a series of prayers in a particular order that took some time to complete, they could knock years off the sentence of the dearly departed, extricating them from purgatory sooner than God would otherwise have allowed. They couldn't do anything for themselves, but at least they could pray for mercy for the departed. Of course, it would be helpful if a coin or two were dropped through the slot for each candle lit. A lot of little candles were flickering behind a lot of red glass, and a lot of pesos and pennies were being dropped into a lot of tin boxes in an attempt to get me to ease up on the suffering being inflicted on the souls in purgatory.
Wow, man, this is unbelievable. And you mean people could not see right through all that? People didn't see it as the desperate attempt of a desperate church to keep its members desperate to do anything to protect themselves from this desperado they called God? You mean people actually bought this stuff?